Living a simple life, what does that really mean? It might sound easy, but if you really want to downsize, tread lightly on the earth, and unplug, it takes a lot of hard work and sacrifice. That's clear in Mark Sundin's new book, The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America. Sundin follows three families of modern homesteaders who've taken radical steps to live differently, to try to break away from global capitalism and have a less destructive footprint on the earth. Mark Sundin joins us now from Portland, Oregon. Mark, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
Exploring these people's lives raises all sorts of questions about the way we live, eat, and work. Introduce us to these people you follow. Let's start with Ethan and Sarah Hughes in Missouri and what motivated them to go off the grid.
Well, Ethan and Sarah, I'd say they wanted to do two things. First, they wanted to boycott the industries that they thought were taking away their freedoms and their destroying their world. So that would be things like petroleum, electricity, computers and cars, as well as taxes for that matter. They didn't want to support the war. And the second thing was they wanted to find meaningful work. That might mean working with their hands, being outside, being with their kids, teaching their kids. And they weren't finding that in modern America. So they set out to do both of those things. They bought a farm that had been owned by an Amish family in Missouri, and they've been living without electricity and without cars for the past 8 years.
How much time did you spend with them in writing this book? Was it multiple visits over many months? What?
Yeah, I made two visits of about 10 days each, spread out over 2 years. So I got a good chance to witness the life they were leading.
Talk about the challenges they and the other families face, because it ain't easy living without electricity and all the other comforts that we take for granted every day.
No, there's a lot of physical challenges, just things like the hard work you have to do to grow your own food and to build your own structures. But maybe even stronger than that is the social pressure to conform. And when you announce to your family and friends that you're going to stop driving in a car, you know, people think you're crazy. Or if you'd announce to your friends that you're going to start farming in downtown Detroit, people think you've lost your mind. And so in some ways, it's those social obstacles that these people had to overcome to live their dream.
And you mentioned Detroit. Olivia Hubert and Greg Willerer take their personal revolution to the challenges of urban farming in Detroit. Tell us more about their story.
Well, I thought this was going to be a book about preppers, that is, the people with their bunkers of food and guns and gold and silver. Mm-hmm. But I realized those people were preparing for this collapse that had already happened in American cities. And that's happened in New Orleans and Detroit with, you know, the ecological catastrophes and the loss of jobs and the blight. So I went to Detroit and I found Greg and Olivia, who were making a living growing vegetables on abandoned lots in Corktown. And they were doing this without any funding from universities or government or nonprofit. And they seemed to have created quite a lovely life for themselves.
What I found compelling about the book is that the motivation of these folks isn't escapism. It seems their lives reflect or are a reaction to a recurring tension in American culture. We love and embrace the outdoors and the land, but we're also destroying it. And there's this desire to get back to a purer, simpler time.
Yeah, we live in a society that encourages us to basically satisfy all of our desires, whether they're economic or career. And these folks have voluntarily embraced limits and restraint and in hopes of finding a deeper abundance than the ones available, I guess, in what you'd call the rat race.
Now, the search for meaning and authenticity beyond the modern life of consumerism and creature comforts is an old one in American history. Teddy Roosevelt talked about this strenuous life. Many others in the late 19th and early 20th century worried deeply that people were losing their connection to the land, were becoming soft and weak by no longer, you know, having to farm and hunt or connect with nature. And of course, the 1960s Back to the Land movement. How much do these folks feel and perceive that they're part of a longer trend in American history?
You know, they're aware of it. And that trend you're speaking of goes way back, you know, to the Puritans and the Quakers and the founding fathers, who were all interested in boycotting industries that they thought were immoral. So that might have been the factories in England or the slave trade in the United States. But yeah, these people are aware of their place in it. That said, none of these people are particularly academic or studious about it. You know, they've kind of followed their gut, which told them they wanted to be outside working with their hands, doing work that felt like it had tangible results. So they know about this, but that's not their main motivation.
In the age of Donald Trump, many people are looking closely at, you know, what constitutes effective resistance to policies and practices they disagree with. How much of their motivation, Mark, is political?
Well, all these people were at some point some kind of political activist, and in a sense, they didn't think that was working well enough. They wanted to live an ethical resistance to the state and to the economy, but they want to do so in a way that they didn't lose their mind and their soul. And I mean, a lot of people are learning this these days with Trump, is that full-time activism, full-time resistance can burn you out pretty quickly. It causes you to a lot of times be looking at a computer all day. It causes you to be away from home, eating bad food, missing your family. So in a sense, these people devised a life in which their acts of resistance happened every day, all day. And there was sort of a unity of the mind, the body, and the spirit.
As you mentioned, these folks aren't preppers, but I did get a sense that they feel deeply the world is in grave danger unless more people decide to live like they do or make serious changes in how they live their daily lives, correct?
Yeah, this book started with the premise that what the scientists say about climate change and species extinction and depletion of the seas is all real. And then I took it to the next step of, like, assuming this is all real and we're causing this, how could we design a life that would remedy this? And so these people have taken that very seriously, and they have designed, in some cases, life completely without fossil fuels or completely without the banking industry, completely without paying taxes for the wars.
What do you know about whether these folks have read the book and what they think about it?
I know that they've all read it, and they have been to some of the events, and so they've been satisfied with it, so that made me feel good. Ethan and Sarah down in Missouri, who believe that, you know, the means is the end, they kind of pressed me really hard to get this book published on 100% post-consumer recycled paper, and I was able to get Penguin to go along with that.
You also profile Lucy Brieger and Steve Elliott, a couple in Missoula, Montana. Talk about some of the unique challenges they face up there in Montana and Big Sky country.
Well, the one of the first things was they lived in a teepee for about 8 years in the early 80s. Their first son was home birthed inside that teepee in the winter. So, again, that physical challenge is huge. But the reason I profiled them was because whereas the other two families had very young children, Steve and Lucy's kids were grown and out of the house, and I was interested to see how they had never really compromised on that ethical vision of small-scale farms like Wendell Berry talks about. But at the same time, they had achieved the American dream. They had a beautiful house, they had land, they were financially stable, and they had kids going off to college.
What do you think folks who aren't headed off the grid will get out of this book?
You know, this was one of the surprises to me, was that I guess I started thinking that in order to live a good life, you had to be a farmer. And when I studied these three families, I realized they were doing what they really love, and they still are doing what they really love. And when you find meaningful work, a lot of the anxiety and the guilt kind of falls away. A lot of those unfulfilled needs fall away. And so I'm hoping that what the reader will find is that if they can look into their own heart and find out what kind of work they love, that's the path for them.
Mark, this book was also something of a personal journey for you. I mean, you've struggled with some of these same questions, as you mentioned in the book. You've been an outdoorsman, a river guide. How much did the book affect your outlook on how much to live in the modern world versus try to forge a separate life a little bit off the grid?
Yeah, I've been trending this way for decades now. And again, there's that combination of, on the one hand, wanting to be outside, wanting to not look at a computer screen all day. On the other hand, trying to figure out how to extricate myself from these industries that I feel like are terrible for me. I mean, I get so angry at the banks, and then I have to write a check to Bank of America every month for my mortgage. Or I should say that's what I did a few years ago. And I thought, how can I break out of the system? I use cars, and I know that the oil industry is destroying us. And I ask, how can I break free from this cycle? And it's hard because the fossil fuel industry makes us all hypocrites. If we say anything bad about it, well, we use cars. So, you know, what are we supposed to say?
Well, where have you landed after this book? Do you think it'll motivate you to change how you live?
I think it already has. One of the first things I did after finishing the book was I went down to Moab, Utah, and volunteered to build a straw bale house for a low-income family, which I found wonderful work and had a tangible product at the end. We had built this beautiful house that people would live in for hopefully 100 years or more and pay only $8 a month in utilities. After that, I went up to Standing Rock, and that's where I saw the intersection of the two most important ideas in this book, which is climate change and racism. And I saw those things playing out on the stage up there, so I went up without any kind of magazine contract and just started reporting on my own.
Mark Sundin's new book is The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America. You can read an excerpt at hereandnow.org. Mark, thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.